Tate Ministry, if you're there. We're going to start. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jonathan Frericks, and this class or session, its series is called Global Hotspots and the Journey to Just Peace. God says yes. How do we respond, basically, in terms of the promises of this, the promises of God that are the theme of this summer at Holden? Very, very relevant to questions about peace, I think, where we try to think about people beyond ourselves, especially. What I'm going to do this week is try to connect a couple places where we either know a lot, but it's not very accurate, or we don't know very much, but in these cases, we're very deeply involved as an American nation. First one being Holy Land, second one being Colombia in Latin America. But running through it all, I want to ask you to think with me in a way that I think is accessible to most people about what really is peace, and try to introduce you to something we're working on quite hard where I work, the concept of just peace. It's not a new idea, but we're putting it into a package and a concept that may actually open it up to more people. I work at the World Council of Churches in Geneva. I work on advocacy, which is exactly what John's talking about next door. I wish we could all go and listen to what he says, because he's a great example of a politician who has a real heart for justice, I think. And advocacy means trying to get governments to do a little bit more of the right thing for everybody. Not the right thing for a couple people or a few people, but the right thing for everybody. So the common good, the public good. And at a global level, it's increasingly critical, I think, for us to think in this way, because ironically, although we're getting more and more globalized, we're also getting more and more narrowed down, I think, most of us, not least because of this machine and how we use it. So what I'm going to do today is share with you three hopes that I have for the Holy Land as an introduction. And then ask you to switch gears and think with me about two aspects of just peace that I think are accessible both to you and to this issue of what is the Holy Land peace problem exactly. Think of the first blue part as zooming in on something, even though it still won't be a microscope, it will still be just a medium shot. And think of this as zooming out to some of the bigger issues that we have to deal with if we really want to be part of something, in a sense that peace has something to do with the gospel, a lot to do with the gospel, very much to do with our lives, nothing to do with our lives, all those sort of questions. So as a way to get us going, I'm going to play you about 10 or 11 minutes of one of the better videos that I've seen about the Holy Land. It's much longer than that, but the intro is very powerful. It's called Occupation 101. And I'm going to start at about 2 minutes. The intro before the 2 minutes is India, the civil rights movement, Ireland, places that in your lifetime, maybe not India so much, but in India at the time of independence in 47, 48, but Northern Ireland, most of you remember, our own civil rights struggle, South Africa. And where I'm going to bring you in, there's a bit of rhetoric from a South African black leader. And he said, I think of David standing against the giant Goliath. And what they do right after I bring it in, I just want to get you ready for this, you switch from South Africa to almost exactly the same scenes in Israel and Palestine. And what strikes me about this video is that all of the countries they look at in the bumper at the beginning are all about an occupation or a dispossession. The blacks in the south and the blacks in the north, in a sense, they weren't occupied because it wasn't their country, but they were certainly dispossessed. So that idea of occupation and dispossession is huge. Creekside is that way.
Sorry.
You're most welcome to pass through. Yeah, it's right next door. You go out, left, and in. Two lefts. One straight away and two lefts. So. This, I think, is a very strong video for many reasons. It's done by a journalist named Allison Weir. And it shows you what you see all the time on the news, but some of the in-depth parts of just this first 10, 11 minutes start to give you an idea of what you're not seeing. And portray, listen, look at the way that the two sides are portrayed. So let's do it. Would you mind getting the light at the back? Could someone take the book away? Yeah. So here's a South African. I may just back that up because I think it's very effective cinematography. So that's the black South African rhetoric. This is South Africa. Remember those trucks? Okay, this is South Africa. South Africa, Israel. Probably Hebron. Israel. Young David the shepherd boy stood up before the great Goliath. Sorry, it's a bit rough, but we're here for peace. Going on a bit long, it is. 40 years. It's one of our helicopters, by the way. Yeah. Voices of the Silence Majority. This is about 2002, the second uprising.
These misperceptions come from the fact that we're only hearing a fraction of the story. You are about to witness images and testimony largely hidden from mainstream America. Thank you.
Christian Peacemaker team.
This is a holy place to significant numbers of us in the world. We all have an interest in sort of seeing what is this land and what's the situation here. And once you come, if you open your eyes at all, you can't miss the problems and the patterns that are here.
I think it's hard to understand what occupation is. I think it's a foreign concept for many Americans, what it's like to live under military occupation.
The definition of an occupation is when a foreign army occupies your land physically and controls your life.
In addition, Palestinians under occupation, and this is why there's so much struggle against the occupation, they're not citizens, they don't have rights, they don't have civil rights. They're under a military rule.
Israeli human rights.
This is a particular kind of occupation.
She's also
that's
Jewish.
Both military and settler occupation.
Settlements are areas of Palestinian land which are selected, and whatever is there, whether it's roads or whether it's villages or homes, they are bulldozed, and then a new town is built on the hilltop.
One very good friend is Rodina Jabber, and she and her husband Optal have land in the rural valley near here called the Ba'ah. And it's pretty clear these settlements want this land, some of the best agricultural land around here. So that valley has had repeated home demolitions. Rodina herself has lived through two home demolitions that are living now in their house.
Settlers writing Hebrew on the walls.
Rodina and her children were once again homeless and had to endure living in a tent for many months. Her husband Atta was even imprisoned for protesting the destruction of their home.
Palestinians that have no
input
whatsoever in the policies that are made. They're not on the city council. They're not in any of the decision-making bodies in the West Bank or Gaza. They're certainly not in the government. The policies are made in order to ensure Israeli control. So the law is designed in a way, in a very cynical way, to prevent Palestinians from building and to keep them confined in little islands so that most of the land of the occupied territories is free for Israeli settlement.
These are on settlements.
Another Jewish man.
190 of them spread all over the West Bank.
Settlements are strategically built colonies of Israel that are connected by a network of roads which separate each Palestinian community from the next and confine their ability to expand. They are often constructed around the best farmland and water resources.
They are surrounded by barbed wire. They are armed inside. Settler residents are required to be armed by the Israeli military. And they are defended from the outside by the Israeli military itself.
The purpose of these settlements today, number one, is to continue the Israeli control and domination of the occupied territories.
And the bottom line in all of this is to make Palestinians leave the country. It's a very hard term, I know, but in a sense it's a kind of ethnic cleansing.
The Israeli government and the Israeli army is not dealing with people as equal. I mean, I think that that's the main problem, that Palestinians are not considered, are not perceived as equals to Israelis.
There is no specific discrimination against Palestinian Christians as opposed to Palestinian Muslims. It's a shared suffering.
Christians seem to very much themselves very much a part of the Palestinian nation. They identify with the Palestinian people as being their people.
Palestinian Christians have difficulty getting to churches on Sunday morning if they wanted to come to Jerusalem because they don't have that permission or that legal right, according to the Israeli government, to come to Jerusalem for worship.
We'll stop there at Virgin Mary Street in the Old City. Would someone turn on the lights and turn off the projector, please? Understand, get it a little bit straight. I think it speaks for itself pretty strongly, but if there are things that you were struck by. Yeah.
One comment I have to make, I was in Israel in 2000, and I see this as very troubling to me because it brings back the vivid memories. It's so hard for us to realize what is actually going on and to look at these settlements and seeing the rubble of homes of people that, and then these beautiful homes built on top, seeing bullet holes, seeing the signs with landmines still alongside the road, even, you know, they joke and say, well, maybe not, you know, left over from the war in 67. I'm glad that we have the opportunity to have this dialogue and to explore it more deeply as to what is actually going on today. And what our response can be, but it's a very difficult issue, very complicated, because there is no right and wrong, there's just plain hurt.
Well, I think there's right and wrong, isn't there?
No.
I don't buy that.
Well, not that there's right and wrong in the issue. I'm talking about the human response. It's just raw hurt, and when, from the Christian perspective, we just need to know what to do and how to respond in a more effective manner.
Yeah.
We've been there 8 times, starting in 1998,
mm-hmm.
and each time we've seen things deteriorate.
Yeah.
Most of the people that were interviewed, we know, and Bishop Muneeb Yunan, as you probably know, is now president of the Lutheran World Federation.
Right.
The rest of the world recognizes what needs to be done. We don't, as Americans.
Just to pick up a little bit on that, what's right and wrong, what's the deepest wrong you heard in those 11 minutes. But the biggest idea at the heart of everything.
The ethnic cleansing element,
yeah.
That the Israelis are trying to fight.
But even deeper, that's a tactic. What's underneath? That one woman said something that really struck me. I agree with you. That's the act that needs to stop. I think it was Yael Stein from Beth Salem, one of the Israeli human rights. She said, they're basically not thought of as equal.
Right.
And I think that's behind what you're saying. I'm just digging down for something we can all kind of grab onto. I think at the end of the day, that's what it is. And occupation requires that. If you want to do an occupation, you basically have to think you're more equal than somebody else. Look at the people from our part of the world, we white folks who came here. Look at any place where two people clash. You have to say that, otherwise you won't be able to do what you want to do. You have to lie to yourself. So just that idea of equality, which pretty much nobody can disagree with, but when you take it into the situation, then we get into some of those things. So I'd like to give you three kinds of hope I have after working on this issue for about 20 years, and always as part of my job, never the whole thing, but always in a wider context. First one, more and more people and organizations are getting involved. I see a lot more peacemakers. Actual people, I think we should use the biblical term peacemakers for, not in a high way, but in a very, very down-to-earth way. People, organizations, churches, and also governments finding an angle or a particular calling to work for peace. This is in addition to all the other good reasons why we can all be interested in peace, but actually doing something about it. I had something to do with starting a World Week of Action for Peace from the World Council of Churches, where we invite churches all over the world to spend the last week of peace in 1967, which is May 29th to June 4th. June 4th was the last day that the Palestinians and the Israelis had the peace borders in operation. And it's important to say that because we're not saying 1948. We're not trying to wipe Israel off the map. That term. We've heard a term many times, suspected. In the movie they said, an ancient enmity that will never be solved. How many times have you heard that? Throw it out. It violates something very, very basic and real about what you know and about what God has made of each of us. So in this World Week for Peace, we invite people in churches around the world who are members of the World Council of Churches. We have about 350 members, including the ELCA and probably most of your churches, PCUSA, United Methodists, Episcopalians, to either educate, pray, educate, or advocate, or all three if they're up to it. Pray, educate, advocate. And here's a little summary of what we've learned. It gives you hope when Australian churches can work for peace in the Middle East. Why? Because their country opened its doors to Jewish refugees that nobody else wanted. And they were also one of the first countries to recognize Israel when it was established. So that gives them some money in the bank. They can stand up and say a little bit more of the truth about these difficult things. It gives you hope when South Africans of all races come to this place and see it, and they take it up with a real power because they know what inequality is. They know what a passbook is, a checkpoint. They know how documents and inequality go together, and racial, the look of your face, and where you come from, and where you want to go, and how that stops you. It gives you hope when Irish people get involved, because they're kind of allergic to foreign domination. Anybody Irish here? We Lutherans don't get much of those, but boy, Ireland punches way above its weight, to use a violent image, in the worlds of humanitarian aid, development aid, and peace work. And it's very strong also then with us on this week, where the Catholic Archbishop, the Church of Ireland Archbishop, which is Anglican, and three or four littler church leaders went to the Holy Land, Israel-Palestine, during the week, and came back and did a national TV program in Ireland. Sri Lankans have watched a minority just get smashed. A terrible, terrible, terrible conflict for 20, 25 years, but now in the last 2 years, there's been a so-called military victory. And is that peace? Does smashing your enemies bring peace? Go to Sri Lanka and ask the Tamils. Swiss churches. Why? Because Switzerland has a bit of a heritage as a place of refuge. It's an armed neutrality, but it also accepts foreigners. And it's accepted quite a few Jews during World War II. Didn't accept the ball, sent a few back, but did quite a few good things for the Jewish people fleeing the Nazis. And today, some of the society, some of it's getting a bit xenophobic, but we have three churches in three of the cantons who've made a real point of welcoming their Muslim and Jewish and Buddhist and other religion people who come to live in Switzerland now, and establishing a house of culture, a house of religions, where the religions can have dialogue and programming. So they use that as their basis for reaching out and taking a bit more of an honest stand about the conflict in the Middle East. Many other countries have discovered their gifts as peacemakers within this church framework, and everything I'm saying is in a church framework pretty much today. Even for an intractable conflict on the other side of the world, they get it. They get it from where they are. They don't think, oh, that's far away, it doesn't affect, I'm not involved. And then one benefit is if you do peacemaking ecumenically, meaning with the whole household of God, ecumenical means the household of God, the inhabited earth, the household of God. If you do it with other Christians, you get the benefit of strength through unity. You put your strength behind the common witness to a common cause. I want to switch to some of the people you saw in the video here already. The fact that, and just a personal note, I went there for, I think, 10 years to work and do jobs there. I was working in the Middle East. And the only Israelis I met were the people who treated you like blank at the airport, the people who treated you like blank at the checkpoints, and the people who treated you like blank at the settlements. And after 10 years only of periodic visits, I realized, whoa, you don't know anybody who's Jewish. I didn't grow up in a Jewish area of USA or part of the world. So I thought, this isn't good. So every trip since then, I've made an effort to try to reach someone on the other side, either introducing myself, going to have a meeting if I have a reason, or finding groups like some of the ones you saw here at Settlement Watch, Human Rights Watch, these kinds of groups that do things in Israel, and there are lots of them. They're generally small, and they're generally harassed by the majority who, not the majority maybe, but the minority on the other side. And maybe with a bit more uninvolved majority in between them. Some of the groups to look for in the news sometimes and to pay attention to, maybe Google them if you want to learn more. Settlement Watch, ACRI, A-C-R-I, Women in Black, Betzalem, Gisha, there's lots of acronyms here, but I can give you them later. Yesh Gvul, two that I want to name in particular, Shimin Esteem and Not in My Name. Shimin Esteem are people who refuse to serve in the army. Everybody has to serve in the army. In one case, I know of the daughter of the head of Shin Bet, the security service, who refused to go and be a soldier. And Not in My Name is soldiers who served, who then, Breaking the Silence is another group. Not in My Name is a broader group than that, sorry. And then Jewish Voice for Peace. There are literally dozens of these kind of groups. And what I think is interesting, they bring their vocations to their peace work. So Jeff Halper, the guy that I said was born in Hibbing, he's an anthropologist. There are others who are lawyers, there are others who are specialists in family counseling. And then, of course, women as a group have been very active in peace, as they tend to be in lots of conflicts. Why is that? Why do women? Hi, guys. Why do women do a lot about peace?
They bear children to die in wars.
Yeah. I think many reasons. They also know about being less powerful, I think. They know about injustice in most countries. And I just want to mention one person in particular, not a woman in this case, but how you get hope. And from that you get understanding, and from that you have opportunities to do something. So one day I went to meet a man I'd heard about named Daniel Bar-On. He's a psychologist at Be'er Sheva University. He was a psychologist at Be'er Sheva. He had passed away not too long after I talked to him. But he had started out as someone whose parents fled the Nazis to study the dynamics of psychology from generation to generation in Germans and Jews. And he wrote lots of books, most of them in German that I saw. But the one that, the sort of headline that has never left me is that he found some of the same symptoms in the children of SS officers and the children of Holocaust survivors. But they could be Holocaust victims, but the children of Holocaust sufferers. Some of the same symptoms. And the twist is, the German children didn't know what their dad did, because I don't think the SS officers came home and regaled the family dinner table with the day's work, right? The worse things you do, the more silent you have to be about it, especially in a family setting and a social setting. So he found similar symptoms. Then he switched over and he started studying the dynamics of conflict in Palestinian and Jewish Israeli families. And he and a Palestinian did marvelous work where they did parallel histories, and you can get the books, where they have Palestinians telling what happened in October 1948, and Israelis telling it, and then pick another time. And they just run them down like parallel texts of the Bible translations. And you see the complete opposite of the experience on both sides. And the right and wrong drips from the pages, absolutely, and the suffering as well. But people suffer where there is right and wrong being violated.
Can I just do something a little corny here?
Please.
I've been going
to Israel. A little corny, are you sure?
A little corny, since 76, I've had 6 trips over there. One of the early ones, I remember a playground along a road that had been bombed the day before from Syria by the Palestinians. We were going up to Sister Rabbi, which was inaccessible for a while. At one village that had the roads bombed just the day before, and we were driving around them, the playground equipment constituted military equipment painted pink and yellow and bright blue, old tanks that were wrecked, and kids were playing them. They were trying to desensitize the terror of that stuff by making these things bright colored play objects. And I really had mixed feelings on that one. Wow.
Yeah.
The children, how do you, oof, thanks.
Well, I asked Mr. Barone at the end of about 90 minutes, what would really have to happen in his opinion as a psychologist for there to be peace? And he replied just like that. He said, the violence has to stop, the day-to-day stuff where you're actually acting on your bad bile about other people. The violence has to stop, and there has to be some kind of rough agreement for 2 generations. And then you could probably put together something that might be stable. And I think that's really an incredible insight. You know it from other situations when you look at them and you've been around them, but he was saying it psychologically, to allow people to reconstruct memories, heal memories, reconstruct relationships, overcome enemy images, put that idea of inequality into the grave and build on that. But in the meantime, you have to still do the kind of things we would think about. Stop the violence, ceasefire, patrols, you know, monitoring forces, other things which keep stuff under control. Well, the deeper things have to happen. But the absence of violence obviously clearly doesn't mean the presence of peace. When you hear stuff like this, I think we can respond with hope, with gratitude, because we learn more and more as we go on about violence and about its consequences. And I think the things that our Creator has been trying to teach us for quite a long time. I'll give you another demonstration of hope for me. We had a conference at the World Council of Churches, sponsored by the Swiss churches. This is the kind of thing they felt able to do, to actually tackle the very tricky topic, and I'm sorry that Michael's here, and any other theologians here, I'm going to see how careful I have to be here now. I'm going to talk theology. Anyway, to tackle the very tricky topic of promised land. What does the promised land mean? And we had 80 theologians from virtually all the camps of the Christian family together in a retreat center for 3 days. Imagine that, 80 theologians for 3 days. The interesting thing was, on this topic, we had the camps who had never spoken to each other in general terms. I mean, some had, but overall, the dialogue on promised land, conversation about it, the writing about it, the scholarship, has gone in different directions. So we had the divides of the church, Protestant, Orthodox, Roman Catholic, and we had the divides of the world, Middle East, West, north, meaning the so-called developed north, and south, meaning the so-called developing south. So South Africans, Germans, German theologians on these kind of questions, you almost get static in the air when they walk in. And in fact, one of them, from the Jewish Christian dialogue stream, who never talks to the Palestinian theologians, or a Muslim theologian, pretty much, but they were together. And the Jewish Christian dialogue, lifelong dialogue person from Germany spoke, and he evoked this really hopeful image of new synagogues being opened in Germany on the same sites where mobs had either burned synagogues in the Kristallnacht in the 30s, when the mobs were turned loose by the Nazis on the Jewish minority, or in some cases in former church buildings that had been shut down and now they're reopened as synagogues. And he spoke of that as incredible signs of hope as these fresh shoots came out finally 40, 50, 60 years later after from the rubble of war. Same timeline that Baron was talking about, basically. And it was a powerful image and a wonderful thing. I talked to him privately, and he told me that he thought Germany had been punished severely for what it had done in World War II. They had been punished. You can think of hundreds of thousands of prisoners who died in Siberia. The Russians took them. They never came back. The country bombed to pieces. Civilians suffering greatly, all those sorts of things. But the new signs were new synagogues were signs of new life finally growing out of the rubble of genocide and war. And for someone who had devoted his life to Jewish Christian dialogue, it was the fruit of a life's work to see this happening, especially where the mobs had burned the synagogue 70 years earlier. It felt like his country's finally turning the page on a dark chapter of its history. And it struck me that, like the Palestinian people, the Jewish people have had a catastrophe. The word in Arabic is Nakba. Nakba means catastrophe. The Palestinians refer to 48 as the Nakba, the catastrophe. And maybe it's obvious, but I really hadn't ever thought of how damaged the Germans are because of their Nakba. And I shared it with him, that idea with him, in a kind of I thought of this and came up in a conversation. He didn't really want to hear it, because as a man devoted to Jewish Christian dialogue, to equate the German experience with a Palestinian experience was too much. But I get paid to say things that people don't want to hear, some of the time. We didn't go very far into it, but to me it's relevant. The psychological scars, not only on people, but on whole societies. And I think I've seen it sometimes in a given country that I know people from over 40, 50 years. There's a change in the people today. If you go to Germany today, it's a really different place from what it was in the 1960s. And I think the way that people behave and think, there's much, much more hope. There's been a lot of healing. I think history will show that hardly a country exists who've tried harder to put their past right than Germany, starting with what happened to the Jewish people. And one more example of hope is this idea of truth. How do you make truth real to people? And a beautiful example is a group called Zochrot. I don't know Hebrew, but what does Zochrot mean? Witness or something? Anybody know? Yeah. This group of very dedicated Israelis goes around and tries to find ways to bring to life the memory of the 600 villages that were erased in 1948. And I went on one of their tours, and they took us to Zipora, which is the traditional home of Mary. It's kind of over about three hills from Nazareth. So Joseph was marrying this nice lady from the town they played basketball against, in the other conference. And today you go there, and we wound our way down through some gardens and rubble and stuff, and you see this beautiful green forested hilltop and hill. And on the top is an old tower sticking up above the trees. And you think, oh, this is really cool. It's so peaceful from a distance. lovely to see the amount of forests that have been grown by the Israelis, with a lot of help from Jews overseas. He lets us soak it in, the guy from Zokhorod, and then he holds up a calendar from, I don't know, 40 years ago or something. And here's a giant picture of that same hill, and it's a complete Palestinian town. There isn't a tree in sight, but the tower is the same. So you know he's showing you the same thing. So then you walk down the little valley and up through the trees up to the top of the hill, and the whole floor of the forest is a bit like Winston, the miners' village, but more. I mean, rough blocks of stuff, absolutely not what a forest floor is made of. So all those trees are doing a wonderful job of hiding something, and it's one of the 600 villages that was wiped out. One other quick thing, because it's so clever. They went to a Lebanese Palestinian. Remember, there are 4 or 5 million Palestinians in exile. They went to a Lebanese Palestinian camp where tens of thousands of people are living without any prospect whatsoever. Been there since 48 in some cases, 60 to 67 in other cases. And they found some graduates of a little school that was the only thing standing from their village. And they took photos of them and blew them up. Like those photos you have in Washington, at least for a while, of Obama, life-size cutouts. You know, like cutout dolls. They took photos of the class of 48 from that little school. And who are these kind of wizened Palestinian men and women? And they blew them up and they brought them to the school as a reunion. The school is now in occupied territory. They can't get there. And then they made a picture of the school with life-size photos of these guys as they are today if they went to a reunion. It's all makeup, of course. And then put it up all over Israel and took it back to Lebanon and said, we'd like to give you this. Here's your school. Here are you today. And people say, well, what are you doing? They put it on the sidewalk in Tel Aviv, but people come by, what is this? And they explain. They just explain, well, these are the people these are the alumni of that school up there by that settlement, you know. Creative and hope building, I think. Give you lots of hope. Research into the real cost and the prolonged consequences of violence. This is zooming out a little bit. Is telling us a lot about what happens when you go to war, when you use mass violence, even if you don't go to war, and the critical importance of preventing violence, because it means that your troubles have not only been not addressed, but have spilled over into something which makes everything much, much worse. And I want to give you an example from that you heard in your news, I'm sure. It's from the Iraq War. Remember that security company called Blackwater? Anybody know what it's called today? Yeah, it's two letters that are hard to say. XZ Corporation or something. Anyway, it's still there and it's still getting contracts and stuff like that. But remember the incident in 06 or 07 where there was a Blackwater helicopter over a traffic circle in Baghdad, and they said they were fired on. So they fired back from the helicopter and they shot a bunch of cars in the traffic circle at rush hour. Well, in one of the cars, they killed a 19 or 21-year-old taxi driver. I think Human Rights Watch went and did research on the different people. There was argument about how many people died. The number is about 16 in the whole traffic circle. But that particular taxi driver was the sole breadwinner for 11 people. Because of the war, his own dad was gone. I'm not sure if his mom was gone, but he had his grandparents, maybe his mother, his siblings, 11 people. And I don't know the total details, but if he's on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, which he probably is, and he's dead, there's no other breadwinner, bunch of minors and two old people. Some of them aren't going to be doing very well, and if you have a few other things going on, like a failed sewage system and any number of other stuff that allows disease to spread, you get a real high chance that maybe some of those people will die, especially the little ones. And somebody in the Lancet, the medical journal, The Lancet, published a study of what they call excess deaths using public health methodology. which was possible to do in Iraq because Iraq had a functioning government. It had excellent health statistics under Saddam Hussein. They took the statistics, they know how many people die in Iraq on a normal year and a normal month, and they transposed that to the first 2 years of occupation, I think it was, of our occupation of Iraq. And their figure was that excess deaths from the and you attribute them to the conflict and its consequences. So I'm saying the dependence of that dead taxi driver, they weren't shot in the war, but if a little kid dies, that kid joins these statistics. So the Lancet study said this: excess deaths from a relatively low-grade violence, I mean, as wars go, I mean, we did shock and awe, but then there wasn't that much. There wasn't much fighting against us, and you had this low-grade violence afterwards, right? Excess deaths, meaning unnatural deaths, are from, I think it was 350,000, this was the first 2 years of the occupation, to 1 million. And they can't say that it's this, they can't say that it's that. Statistically, it could be either end. It's probably somewhere in the middle. But compare that with what figure do you think of as the cost, the human cost of the Iraq war?
The U.S. soldiers.
Yeah, we're up to 4,000, right?
Yeah.
So that's really important for us and for some Iraqis. You don't usually get the number of combatants from the Iraqi side killed. When I was there about 4 days after they had pushed Saddam Hussein over and his ankle bones, the rebar in his ankles, I'm talking about his statue.
Mm-hmm.
Remember when they pushed it over?
Mm-hmm.
Parts of him were still lying there, and you could see that Saddam Hussein had rebar for bones. And it was pointing at funny angles. And it was a weird time. And I kept asking people, how many Iraqis have been killed in this little war so far? And nobody knew, nobody knew. But everybody said 10,000 at that point. Whether it's true or not, I can't tell. I've never heard a good figure. But you can add those two together, but they bear no resemblance whatsoever to the real cost of war. So, you know, some of us might be able to think about those things at a time when if we get ready to invade somebody else. And it puts a real onus on pretending that injustice and violence are okay. Makes it pretty hard to say that that's a viable policy for a country to take. And it also puts a different spin on whether or not peace is just some sort of an ideal that a few people like to talk about. And I hope I don't sound like an idealistic person when I talk about peace. It's hard not to, because you are idealistic, you're hopeful. But it's hope that we might speak of, as we heard last week, and as is very appropriate in this case, as hope against hope. In the Bible studies last week and in some of our sessions, this theme came up quite often, and the idea that you're hoping against hope because you have a God-given hope. You have a vision of life which goes to things bigger than our darker side, to the well-being of all of us and to what God has offered to us. I think I need to maybe jump ahead to a couple specifics of how we can respond to this, and then maybe spend a bit of time on the wider question of just peace. I wanted to give three examples of response that I've got up here as travel, global economics, and theology. I think it's fair to say that international affairs used to be much more about government-to-government stuff, political stuff, stuff that we didn't have much of a handle on, and today it's much more about culture, economics, and government-to-government things, and the international rule of law, and some of the great advances of the last century are actually a smaller proportion. They're getting stronger, but they're less than other things that are going on. And I would throw in that movement of people's contact with people if you travel. And so advocacy about peace can look way beyond just trying to get a government to behave in a certain way, by going and talking to them and reasoning with them and hoping that they'll be reasonable and bringing your million signatures. I want to connect the way most of us are actually involved in the world economy and the world of human interaction in ways that are more than we have been in recent decades. And three quick examples related to Israel-Palestine travel. You saw a reference to Christian peacemakers teams. This is a peculiar form of travel, right? You decide you're going to go and speak with people on the street and soldiers and take down information and put yourself in harm's way. In that case, they actually do put themselves in harm's way. There's another group called Ecumenical Accompaniment Program for Palestine and Israel. It's run by the World Council of Churches in combination with about 15 countries. And U.S. people go as these EAs, Ecumenical Accompaniers. Similar to CPT, a little bit of a different methodology, not really too willing to have people get hurt. And going for 3 months, but all ages, anyone in this room could go to Israel-Palestine as an EA, Ecumenical Accompaniment Program for Palestine and Israel. And it'll be a ministry of presence, a ministry of solidarity, and a ministry of witness when you get home. One French EA came back, he was a 25-year-old student, and he gave 100 talks in churches after his time. So just ways to bring the message home in human form as an eyewitness with your credibility, your commitment. I'm just giving that as an example of sort of the far end of travel turning into advocacy. Michael?
Do they have specifics in terms of who they accompany?
Yeah, there's 6 sites, 5 in the West Bank and 1 in with the Israeli peace groups. And you get located in a house and with a set of duties that go with that site. So if you're in Hebron, you walk little children to the last Palestinian school in the old city of Hebron, where 300 settlers have caused, by the army protection of them, the evacuation of 2,500 Palestinian homes and businesses in the old historic city of the most important Palestinian city after Jerusalem. There's one Cordova school is left in the middle with a woman headmistress and about 97 kids, and the EAs walk the kids past the settlers' homes every day to get them to school and get the eggs and the cow dung or donkey dung and the stones, the little stones that the teenage settlers throw at them. That's just one example. There are a lot of times, the Bethlehem checkpoint, Rachel's tomb, you get up at 4 in the morning and you just go to the checkpoint and watch the soldiers. If somebody's watching them, they behave better. 3,000 Palestinians are there at 4 o'clock in the morning waiting to get into Israel to go to their jobs if they have them. Specific things like that. So it's you know, grassroots level human rights monitoring in a sense. The United Nations sometimes gets reports from us. And specific duties that go better if there's a foreigner present. You talk to the soldiers a bit, you get to know the soldiers. And then the Israeli peace groups do lots of things which we join in. But nobody on the Israeli side wants to be accompanied. We don't have Israeli neighborhoods where we're welcome. Maybe someday. Just the second category, quickly, global. Let me mention one other thing. You've got CPT, so you can look that up. You've got EAPPI, you can look that up. There's another thing that could affect actually the most people, and it's the Palestinian Initiative for Responsible Tourism. Palestinian Initiative for Responsible Tourism. And you can go to their website and find a code of conduct for responsible tourism. And it tells you things like, hey, you're coming to see Jesus' historic sites? Please come and meet the surviving Christians who are his closest living cousins. You've been there, if any of you have been there, you know about this, but ironically, the vast majority of devout Christians who come from overseas, and I've been saying this myself for 30 years, and it's been true for as long as people have traveled there, the vast majority of Christians who come there never meet a Christian, because their guides are all from the occupying side. and the money from that you spend as a Holy Land pilgrim Christian, 98% of it goes to into Israeli pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gotten worse and worse and worse as we believe that Palestinian areas are too dangerous to go to, or we won't be safe unless we go in a tour group. And if you could hear what you're told about, there's Bethlehem, but watch out, it's a tourist town, and we're going to take you there, but you have to stay with a group and go to the Holy Manger and back out, and we'll leave, you know. I mean, it's complete, not very true. The second thing, global economics, and this is really about how you shop and how you invest. Shopping here for Israeli settlement products is a bit difficult, I think, but there's a website called whoprofits.org, and there's a website called Settlement Products, or Boycott Settlements, I think, Boycott Settlements. You can also just Google them. And you get lists of products. Now, a lot more of them are in Europe, but the idea that it's good to boycott settlement products is, I think, a very strong one, a very important one, because then you're letting your dollars speak for you. I know that Ahava, anybody use Ahava Cosmetics? A-H-A-V-A? They advertise that they're made with Dead Sea salt and all this stuff. That's an example of a settlement product. In Europe, there's lots of fresh produce from settlements. There's also water taken from the Golan Heights, Eden Springs, bottled water. And because of action by churches and other groups, whole cities have thrown back their contract to have Eden Springs water. Said, we don't want it. It's stolen from Golan Heights. It's stolen from land that you guys are occupying. And the most dramatic story I know of is a Swedish church initiative where they found out that a Swedish company named Assa Abloy had bought an Israeli lock company called Multilock. And they did research for about 6 months about how that Multilock factory was in a settlement, and how under international law, if you have a factory in a settlement and you have displaced the people who used to live there and you bring in your own workers from Israel, you're guilty of the crime that we know from the Bible, which is now in international law, called pillage. And in Sweden, a smallish country with fairly high standards of social conduct and a residual Christian commitment that's quite strong, they announced the results of their study at 10 o'clock in the afternoon at a press conference, and telling that Assa Abloy was guilty of pillage. And at 5 o'clock that afternoon, the CEO came on the TV and said, we're going to move the factory out of the settlement back into Israel Park. So a dramatic example. There are more and more things like that, not always so cut and dry, but where corporations are feeling nervous about being on occupied territories. And you can get involved with it if you look at your own investments. And if you want to be really dynamic about it, you could sell Caterpillar if you have Caterpillar stock. You could sell Volvo. They also make bulldozers that crush the houses in the West Bank. We're talking about actions in the West Bank. We're not talking about Israel. The corporations might have headquarters in Israel. They might be American corporations. There's about 100 American corporations involved in the occupation. ITT, Motorola. Maybe got a Motorola cell phone. Motorola provides lots of equipment for the Israeli military. And it's a growing movement to boycott the occupation. Some people want to boycott Israel too. We don't say that because as Christians we think we have to, not, that's a mixed message about our attitude to the Jewish people. But over the line, it's an important thing to get into. A few questions. Just under theology, I wanted to say, Promised Land is one example. Chosen People is another example. There are others, but our theology is actually an accomplice, in some cases, to the occupation. And you can find quite a bit of information about that. And if you were into that and did some research, it could be a fruitful dialogue with your pastor that at least when these topics came up, they weren't treated in a way that inadvertently supported the this idea that this age-old conflict, and that even God gave me the title to this land. It's right here. This is the title to my land. I'm a settler or a Christian Zionist. And here's the title to the land that I've just stolen and the people I've killed to get it. I don't think so. But new ways to connect who we are and what we do every day with the global situation where you have a hot spot that is going on and on and on. I'll come to the Just Peace stuff tomorrow, maybe. We have a couple minutes if there's more questions or comments.
A couple comments, so if there are questions.
I learned a lot.
We have a very either sleeping or stunned balcony. SNS. Please.
There's an international boycott, divestment, and sanctions program going on right now. And Israel every year has a wonderful arts festival where they bring in musicians and dancers and what have you, people from all over the world. And this year they set it all up, and most of the international people did not show up because they believe this is a way to economically make them change their mind. And one other thing, we have a local co-op in Olympia, Washington, that has two stores, and they've pulled three products off the shelves because they were made in the occupied territories.
And they found out about it from people like you.
Well, yes. And but anyway, there's a huge controversy. I've written letters to the editor and had one published, and one's probably being published now in favor of this. But there, people are thinking, you know, we're attacking the Jewish people.
Right.
No, we're not. We're not attacking Israel. We're attacking the Israeli government for the occupation. But it's a powerful thing.
Yeah, and you'll get hit for doing
it.
Oh, yeah. But you have to be clear what you're doing and how far you're willing to go and stand on it.
Sure.
You're supposed to back down.
Yeah.
You're supposed to, most of us do back down. We get hit so hard, we back down. And that's what we're supposed to do. Jeff Halpern's the first guy to tell you that. You're supposed to be afraid of us, we Jews, because we talk hard, we have a lot of opinions, and we know we can get, we got your number. We're too nice. He says, you Christians are too nice. Meaning in a weak way, in a weak way. So I'm not saying be violent or be obstreperous. I'm saying be clear and be solid in what you take action and stand on it. Don't back down. Yeah.
Is there anything that we could learn from South Africa when they changed the apartheid? And it didn't seem like we were involved a whole lot.
Well, you know, it went for a long time before it really took off.
Yep.
And it's a big deal where I work. I mean, it's one of the things the World Council thinks is the best it's ever done, getting churches involved. They were a lot more involved maybe than this country. But the actual boycott of South African products, and there you had a tiny minority oppressing a vast majority in many different factors that aren't, you can't make a parallel. People want to say what the Israelis are doing is a lot like apartheid. And I think it's a fair comment. But if you say it, you shut down debate, and you get into big argument and stuff like that. It's better to look at the behaviors and say, is this acceptable? You know, start from principles like equality and look at the behaviors and say, is this acceptable? It absolutely isn't. But you asked about it, and here it is. Last year, 12 or 14 Palestinian church Christians put out a Kairos document called Kairos Palestine. Kairos document is a little bit of a tiny trend started by the South African Christians who in about 83 put out the original Kairos document, at least of our lifetimes, saying this is a Kairos moment. We have to stand with the resistance to apartheid. So they tried to do the same thing. Last November, December, we launched it in Bethlehem. I have a copy right here. You can get it on Kairos Palestine. And just to hold you for two more seconds, you mentioned boycott, divestment, sanction. If you get involved in this, you'll see those letters all the time. Boycott, divestment, sanction. And the Palestinian civil society called this to boycott everything from Israel, divest from Israel, sanctions against Israel. Well, sanctions are a governmental step. You could call the government to do it, but people can't do sanctions. You can divest from Israel if you want, and you can boycott Israel. these guys sort of go there and sort of don't. They don't quite follow our policy as their fellowship of churches. But the first reference they make is they say Palestinian civil organizations as well as international organizations, NGOs, and religious institutions call on individuals, companies, and states to engage in divestment and in an economic and commercial boycott of everything produced by the occupation. That's the first mention. And then they go farther each time they mention it. And this is a 14-page document. It's got lots of good stuff in it. They say, we love you. The Palestinians say here, we love you, to the Israelis. You don't ever see that said like this. People say it to you, that they have no problem with Israelis, but for them to put it in a formal document, it's a big deal. The only things that got any press were the call, the third of the calls where they actually say boycott Israel. So you might get farther if you don't go all the way with this kind of issue, because Israel has a lot of legitimate needs, and there are 5-6 million people, and they aren't going to go away. So that's a fait accompli, I think. But the occupation is not sustainable. Thank you for your intent.
This might be opening a whole new big thing, but it just quickly, are the Israelis who are going to the settlements choosing to go there for jobs, or why are they going?
Well, some are going for religious reasons. They really think they're getting back to the title, the land to which they have the title. I think the biggest majority would be people taking advantage of cheap mortgages, lovely neighborhoods, theaters, swimming pools. I don't think there's any place in the world where the first world and the non-world are closer together than these cities on the hill, which are California suburbs. They're California suburbs. So they make it attractive with low the government makes it attractive with low mortgages, 24/7 security with the Israeli army around. You get to keep a gun in your house too. But then you get the much crazier settlers who are setting up outposts, and they expand and harass any Palestinian around them and push out the area of control. They root up olive trees. They shoot at the ground. One village is reoccupied by its original inhabitants of about 7 families because the ecumenical accompaniers are living with them now. They left. They went back as long as we agreed to live with them, because the settlers come all the time. And you see the settlers' houses on this horizon, and then you see them starting on that horizon over that hill, and then you see a chicken factory and a settlement over there, and these guys are living down in this little wadi where they've been since time immemorial. And those are the crazier settlers. But I think that I'd say over half are just really doing what you would do, and I would do this. Nice mortgage, freeway straight into Israel. And you saw the map. The amazing thing is you can live in a settlement and work in Tel Aviv on the other side of the country. It's such a little country. It's a bit of a drive, but you can certainly work in Jerusalem. You can work in anything right on the line, no problem. And you have a totally Israeli-only freeway to do that on. The Palestinians are going underneath, going on dirt tracks, walking, climbing over barriers, on other roads. There's two systems, one placed on top of the other. The bulldozer is more important than the tank in this sort of occupation. And as Jeff said, the plan is to get rid of the Palestinians, slowly, not too fast, because then people might notice. Anyway, you can see that one can talk and talk.
Yeah.
Bye, thank you very much.
Thank you.